Chapter 26. A sibilant hiss greeted Barrett as he entered the courtroom, and instantly he saw that Ivins had packed the gallery with CDMI shareholders. Not the institutional shareholders, of course. Not the ones with votes who mattered. No, these were the young women whose parents gave them a few shares upon their college graduations because they adored the company's labels so much. Then there were the middle-aged men who used to jerk off to Madame's famous poster. They bought their shares out of erotic nostalgia. These were Ivins's typical constituent shareholders, the ones who owned just enough shares to file nuisance lawsuits and become thorns in the company's side. Ivins was there, of course, working his way through the crowd, glad-handing them like a politician, while Barrett's lawyer, Dick Harrington, was sitting alone at counsel table with his head down. Barrett took a seat beside him. How's it looking? Harrington shook his head and continued reading his notes. This motion wasn't his idea. He didn't think the judge would disqualify Ivins from the Palmer case. He resisted, but Barrett insisted. That was the dynamic of this particular attorney-client relationship. Lawyers made the worst clients, so the saying went, but only because they refused to be buffaloed. Barrett turned to scan the courtroom. Phil Duval should have been there and wasn't. Detective Riley shouldn't have been, yet was, seated alone in the last row of spectator seats. Barrett immediately got up and made his way back there. Detective, he said, I'm surprised to see you here, considering your case is closed. Riley looked up through his rheumy eyes. They're never closed until there's a conviction, Mr. Barrett. And all appeals have been exhausted, not to mention habeas writs. But your work is done, surely. Never hurts to double check. Barrett eyed him. Riley was a short timer, he reminded himself. He was only punching a clock until his pension kicked in. He'd probably come here to kill some time while he pretended to work. It was Cruz who actually worked the case, and since he wasn't here, there couldn't be anything to worry about. The bailiff cried, "All rise," and Barrett returned to his seat as the judge took the bench. Margaret Delacourt, a hatchet-faced 50-year-old and a legal lightweight who'd managed to parlay her husband's political connections into a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. She'd all but flirted with Mark Ivins in their last appearance on this case, and Barrett braced himself for more of the same. The original motion to disqualify class counsel, filed the same day Lambert was sprung from jail, was based on nothing more than that. Ivins, having no prior relationship with Lambert, was obviously banking on gaining access to privileged information. But Ivins had changed the landscape when he doubled down in his opposition papers, admitting that he'd not only posted her bail, but made her one of the associates in Mark Ivins and Associates. That he'd bailed her specifically for that purpose, but only because she was a brilliant and talented lawyer, not because he was seeking any confidential information. Harrington then amended the motion, arguing the more conventional basis for disqualification, that Lambert had a conflict of interest that had to be imputed to Ivins and the rest of his firm. Barrett was called first to the stand. He testified that he'd hired Lambert specifically to work on the Palmer case, which she had done exclusively for the 1 month of her employment. That in the course of her work, she'd become familiar with a great deal of confidential and privileged company information. Information that was protected from discovery in the litigation. Information to which Mark Ivins was definitely not entitled. Barrett was prepared to testify to much more. That on February 1st, he discovered her resume fraud. That on February 2nd, he instructed the company's director of human resources to fire her. That said director did so that evening. That she subsequently died of a gunshot in an elevator occupied only by herself and Ms. Lambert. And that the police subsequently arrested Ms. Lambert and charged her with murder. But Ivins stood in objection to Harrington's opening question. Your Honor, this line of examination has no relevance to the disqualification issue. Moreover, the facts are hotly disputed. Unless Your Honor wishes to try the criminal case and decide the guilt or innocence of Ms. Lambert. I most certainly do not, the judge said. Moreover, I, along with most of the American public, am already well familiar with the allegations made against Ms. Lambert. Mr. Ivins, your objection is sustained. Mr. Harrington, confine your examination to Rule 1.10 and the subject of privileged information and imputed knowledge. Harrington gave up without a fight. He had no further questions for Barrett, and Ivins had none at all. Seething, Barrett left the stand and returned to his seat. Ivins took the stand next. He looked flashy, even in a conservative gray pinstripe. It was his hair. It was too long, too bright, like a lion's mane, a totem of his virility. He smiled up at the judge, and she frowned down at him, a thinly disguised effort to hide her blatant infatuation. A young woman, some puppet from Ivins' office, conducted his examination. She read from a script that he'd obviously prepared, with each question simply a cue for his next monologue. He began by disputing the contention that he had no prior relationship with Ms. Lambert. To the contrary, he declared, he came to know her well when she was a rising star at the Jackson firm. In fact, she bested him in an important case and won his great respect and admiration. He lost track of her over the years, but instantly remembered who she was when he read about her arrest and imprisonment. He reviewed the evidence against her and became convinced that she was innocent. Object, you idiot, Barrett hissed, and Harrington did. But the puppet was prepared. Since Mr. Ivins's motive in hiring Ms. Lambert was under attack, the young woman argued, it was indeed relevant to know what he learned and came to believe about her. Objection overruled. Ivins resumed. He'd made some further inquiries and learned of Ms. Lambert's amazing fortitude. He was told that she was a model prisoner and a valuable assistant in the jail's business office. And she actually set up a legal aid clinic at the women's unit at Valhalla, he raved. She went out of her way to help these young women with their legal problems. Anyone else would have been brought low by false imprisonment. But Shay was just so brave. Which isn't surprising when you think how hard she fought to prevent that tragic suicide in the elevator. Barrett hissed again, and Harrington stood to object on the same grounds of relevance raised by his adversary earlier. The judge, in an effort to appear fair, sustained that objection and instructed Ivins' puppet to confine herself to the Rule 1.10 issues. The young woman nodded. That was apparently in her script, too. Prior to posting Ms. Lambert's bail, were you aware that she'd worked on the Palmer case? Not at all. Her name never surfaced in any of the filings or correspondence. It's a big multinational corporation. They must have hundreds of lawsuits going at any given time. There was no reason to suspect she'd worked on Palmer. How did you learn the truth? She told me, the moment she got in my car at Valhalla. What was your response? I told her that I understood she had a duty of confidentiality, and that we had a duty too, and would do everything the rules require. And even before her first day of work, we had a Chinese wall in place. The ethical screen the rules require. He'd hired a professional, an expert in legal ethics, to set up the ethical screen. An office-wide edict went out that no one in the firm have any communications with Ms. Lambert about CDMI or the Palmer case. All the firm's electronic files relating to CDMI or the Palmer case were password protected. And all the physical files were locked so that Ms. Lambert could not access them. She brought no such files with her, so there was no risk in that regard. And she was assigned an office far removed from anyone working on the Palmer case, so there was not even a risk of casual eavesdropping. On cross-examination, Harrington scored a minor point regarding the relatively small size of Ivins's firm, in terms of both personnel and physical space. Ivins also admitted to a great degree of collegiality and extra office socializing among himself and his employees. But he refused to admit that any of those circumstances might lead to a breach in the firm's Chinese wall. Mr. Ivins, please tell the court exactly what prompted you to hire Ms. Lambert. I'm always on the lookout for talented young lawyers. I plan to fully exploit her talents.
But was that your only motivation?
Didn't her previous employment at CDMI factor into your hiring decision in any way? Ivins turned a disarming look up at the judge. I have to admit that it did. You see, I believe that Ms. Lambert has been falsely accused, and I want to do everything I can to help her in her quest for exoneration. Barrett's stomach pitched at the look on the judge's face. She was buying it, everything Ivins was shoveling at her. The final witness was the outside ethics expert hired by Ivins to set up the Chinese wall. He testified that he was a member of the New York State Bar, that he served for many years on both the bar's Committee on Professional Ethics and the Attorney Disciplinary Committee, and that he designed, implemented, and monitored the ethical screen put in place between Shea Lambert and all personnel working on the CDMI matter at Mark Ivins and Associates. It was his opinion that the Ivins ethical screen met and exceeded all requirements and assured the protection of CDMI's privileged information. Harrington cross-examined him about the fees he charged, but it was a waste of time. There was no jury, and the judge's conscience was beyond being shocked by astronomical expert fees. That concluded the evidentiary portion of the hearing. The judge heard brief legal arguments from Harrington and Ivins, then issued her foregone conclusion from the bench. The motion to disqualify Mark Ivins and Associates as class counsel in the Palmer litigation was denied. I told you, Harrington muttered as he packed up his files. Barrett didn't linger for any more recriminations. He pushed his way through the crowd of Ivins's groupies clogging the center aisle. Detective Riley was still in the back row on the left, and Barrett did a deliberate about-face in the other direction. And there in the back row on the right was Shay Lambert. He almost didn't recognize her. Gone was the mousy brown hair and the girlish ponytail. Gone was the cheap beige suit and the prim button-to-the-neck white shirt. Today, she wore a sleek black dress, and her hair was long and loose and lit through with a shimmer of golden strands. She looked glamorous and, as she rose to her full height, formidable. She locked eyes with him, and in her cold stare, he suddenly saw that it wasn't only exoneration she was bent on. She wanted revenge. He felt suddenly breathless. He shoved past the last knot of people in the aisle and burst panting through the double doors. Lester Willard was leaning against the wall in the corridor, trying and failing to look inconspicuous. Barrett rushed past a woman by the door and closed in on Lester. "Sir," Lester said, straightening. I know she's in there, Barrett snapped. Where's Culligan? I wouldn't know, sir. There were certain things Lester made it his business not to know, and Barrett guessed that Culligan's latest bender was one of them. He grabbed the back of Lester's neck and pulled his head down to his level. He spoke into his ear. You need to grab her. Next chance you get. No more fucking delays. Yes, sir, but Lester cut a quick glance down the corridor. She's got security now. Barrett followed his gaze to the woman by the courtroom door. She had short hair and wore an ill-fitting pantsuit and a pair of soft-soled Rockports masquerading as Oxfords. She had to be either a bodyguard or a lesbian lawyer. Or both. Fuck, he said. Then, just the one. So far. He thought a second. Unless she's wearing an adult diaper, she's got to take a leak at least once a day. Stay on Shay. Find your opening. Do my best, sir. Lambert's stare sent a chill through Barrett that lasted the rest of the day. He smoked through half a pack on his office balcony while he brooded over it. He tried to reach Culligan at all his numbers, but he didn't pick up at any of them. His assistant tried to cover for him, said he wasn't feeling well, and must have turned off his phone. but Barrett knew he was either drunk or deliberately dodging the calls. Lately, Culligan had shown little stomach for the whole operation. Oh, he was fine with it provided everything happened on the other side of the planet. Or, probably more to the point, provided it didn't happen to white people. His attitude changed once it involved Shay. He even tried to argue against the Tony Lowe operation. Barrett also tried and failed to reach Phil Duvall. His Manhattan assistant reported that he was in Tor. His Tor assistant reported that he was in Manhattan. This all started out as a group enterprise. Each of them agreed it was the only way. They even got Madame's blessing on the operation. Then Lucy jumped ship. Duvall feigned ignorance. Madame went even deeper underground. And now Culligan was ghosting him. Barrett stood all alone in the crosshairs of Shay Lambert's revenge. Dread clawed inside his belly like a caged rat. He wondered if it was possible to develop a bleeding ulcer in the course of a single day. He chugged half a bottle of Pepto and left the office before 5. At home, he startled the latest maid, thrust his coat and case at her, and trudged wearily up the stairs to the bedroom. He stopped short. A rustling sound came from Melanie's dressing room, followed by a long, contented, "Oh," breathed in a tone he remembered from their first years together. It wasn't possible, he thought. But after today, he knew that anything was. His stomach churning, he stole silently across the embrasure into the adjoining room. Melanie was there, but not with another man. No, with something nearly as bad. She was preening in front of her floor-length mirror, alone but for the 3 Melanies smiling back at her, each of them wearing an elaborate ball gown. It was emerald green silk, with a fitted bodice and a skirt that swirled around her hips and legs like a corkscrew. She noticed his reflection beside hers.
"You caught me," she said with a coquettish smile. "I was going to wait and surprise you on the night of the gala."
The Met Gala. It hit him. What the gown must mean. And the rat in his belly clawed through his stomach into his guts until his blood ran thick with bile and excreta. The Met Gala was the most exclusive social event in the city, and somehow he'd promised her an invitation. It was nothing but a reflex, a defensive maneuver to ward off her bitter resentment after he failed to get her a ticket to the Graziella runway show. He was a fool to make such a promise, but she was the greater fool to imagine that marrying a lawyer, even one so prominent as he, could ever gain her entree to that world. "Send it back," he said. "We're not going."
"What?"
The blood drained from her face, turning her skin a sickly white against the green silk. "We're not going," he said again, and walked away.
"You promised! Barry!"
The crackling noise followed him. It sounded like dry kindling catching a spark. Another minute, and it would burst into flame. "I lied." He loosened his tie as he crossed the embrasure again to his own dressing room. "Send it back."
"I can't. It's couture. They made it just for me."
"Tell them you'll list it on eBay. That'll get them to take it back."
"I won't. I'm going to that gala, with you or without you."
It was one of her favorite games, to dangle hints of all the other men who'd gladly take his place in her life. He had no patience for it tonight. He went into his dressing room and closed the door in her face. He locked it. She let out an astonished shriek. He went through to his bathroom and closed that door too, and sank down on the ledge of the tub. He pressed a fist against his churning stomach as Lambert's cold, dead stare flashed again in his memory. There was something lethal in her pale eyes, and it chilled him all the way down to the cold, hard porcelain beneath him. The sound of breaking glass came from their bedroom. Melanie was throwing things. A thought came to him. So sudden and unexpected, it was like a streak of lightning split the sky. It was something that had never once crossed his mind.
but now it seemed so obvious he couldn't believe he'd never thought it before. Maybe Lucy's death wasn't suicide. Maybe he'd framed Lambert for a murder she actually did commit. He saw her again in his memory. The black sheath dress, as smooth and glossy as a shark's skin, her hair and its otherworldly glow, her pale eyes glittering like shards of glass. She wanted him dead. He knew that. And if she'd killed once, she could surely do it again. He pulled out his phone. The number wasn't in his contacts. Saving it there would have suggested more of an ongoing relationship than he was willing to admit. But he scrolled through his call log until he found it. He stared at it for a long time while Melanie pounded on the dressing room door. What time was it in KL? 7 a.m.? Though why should he care? When you were about to embark on something like this, the niceties of civilized discourse hardly mattered. His finger hovered over the number.
Barry, let me in, you bastard, Melanie howled.
He pressed it.
Hey, boss,
Tony Lowe answered.
You sent the package?
Barrett cleared his throat. No. We're having trouble getting delivery on this end. So we need a plan B.
Okay.
You have people over here, right?
Sure, lots. What kind of people you need?
Barrett searched for a euphemism, a way to extend the package metaphor. Instead of a pickup, a takeout. He winced as he said it. There was no way anyone could understand what he meant. Lowe was silent for a long moment.
Sure, boss, he said finally, with a snicker in his voice. But that's gonna cost more. A lot more.
He understood.
Chapter 27. I used to think my life changed in an instant. The instant I lost my job at Jackson Reader's. But in hindsight, I knew that wasn't true. The seeds of the Great Recession were sown years before, and the firm had been missing its profit per partner benchmarks for some time. The axe that severed my life into before and after had been swinging for a long time before it landed. But this time, my life really did change in an instant. The instant I walked out of the women's unit at Valhalla and into Mark Ivan's car. 3 weeks in, this was my new life. I woke early and well-rested in my king-size bed, made a cup of coffee in the DeLonghi, and drank it standing at the French doors, where I could watch the first fingers of sunlight creep into the garden. The hyacinths were in bloom in the borders, and I opened the door to drink in their lush, intoxicating scent. But of course they were in bloom. Everything in this garden was forced in a hothouse and not brought here until its moment of perfect beauty, then whisked away when the flowers faded. There was never any awkward in-between phase in Mark's garden. It was much like the women who worked for him. They all seemed to be at the peak of their beauty and were probably pensioned off when their looks started to fade. Nonetheless, they all adored him. One of my favorite pastimes was guessing which of them he was sleeping with besides Phoebe. Maybe all of them. After coffee, I dressed in a t-shirt and leggings and went next door to the firm's basement-level gym. Two of my coworkers were already there, spinning to the heavy bass beat of dance music. I greeted them with a nod and mounted the treadmill and watched the morning news while I ran 5 miles. Phoebe arrived as I was dismounting, and while we spotted each other on the weights, she updated me on all the office gossip, both professional. Mark's settlement with Genco would give him 5 seats on the reconstituted board of directors. He'd be in control of that company just as he controlled a dozen others. And personal, Mark and his wife were having a rough patch. She had family money, but Mark's net worth had outstripped hers, and that had to change the dynamic of their marriage. We parted after the requisite reps, and Phoebe got on the treadmill while I went through the elevator and back to my apartment. Next up in the schedule of my new life, a rain shower, followed by an hour at my desk responding to emails and reviewing pleadings. My office was here in my apartment. This was Mark's solution for maintaining the Chinese wall between me and the Palmer team, but it suited me well. I didn't care to fraternize with the rest of the and associates. I didn't plan to be with them that long. I also spent some time poking into the firm's electronic records. Except for the password-protected files, I had full access, and browsing through the various pleadings and correspondence and financial records was an easy way for me to get the lay of the land here. It was also the way I'd uncovered the mystery of how Mark happened to bail me out of jail only minutes before Barrett's people would have. He'd been slipping money to the bail clerk at Valhalla from the first week of my incarceration. He'd known all along that I was in there. But until the clerk tipped him off that my bail was about to be posted by Jack Culligan, there was no reason for him to do anything about it. I didn't blame him for that delay. Obviously, he couldn't be sure I'd be an asset to him until he learned that I was a liability to Barrett. I then spent 15 minutes on the internet to see what stories people were dreaming up about me today. It was astounding how famous I'd become. Not infamous, not notorious, but actually famous. As if I'd accomplished something beyond being in the wrong elevator at the wrong time. The irony was that I soon would accomplish something, very real if my plans came to fruition, but nothing I would ever be celebrated for on the internet. My fame would be fleeting, which meant I needed to capitalize on it now. I got dressed in a crisp red suit, summoned Lonnie for a ride downtown, and alerted Alice, who was waiting at my front door when I emerged. She was 40, a faded blonde with a short, no-nonsense haircut, and a rock-hard body that put my morning exercise regimen to shame. A former state trooper who was once part of the governor's security detail, she was now my bodyguard, hired by Mark the day I told him I was being followed. That was also the day he granted me the use of his car and driver. Now, whenever I left the building, it was in the silver Mercedes with Lonnie at the wheel and Alice riding shotgun. Though not literally. Her weapon of choice was a Glock 17, which she wore in a shoulder holster under her suit jacket. She also wore a coiled wire at her ear, linked to Lonnie in the car. First stop was a cafe on Union Square. Alice went in to do a sweep, then gave the all-clear signal to Lonnie, who gave it to me. The reporter was already there waiting. He stood up when I came in and waved me to the table.
"Morning. Thanks for meeting me," he said as I sat down.
He leaned forward, elbows on the table, eager to make his pitch, even before I picked up the menu. He was one of four reporters vying for my story. Although I'd made it clear that I could not discuss my case, the murder charge hanging over my head was the obvious hook. But they were each offering a different approach to the story, and I was still deliberating who should get the exclusive. At the moment, I was leaning toward the freelancer who dangled a feature story in Vogue. A frothy choice, admittedly, but I couldn't help thinking that the photo shoot would be fun. This one was pitching the social media angle, how the online debate about the case had caught fire, and how it might impact the final verdict. He was a little daunted when I told him I'd never dabbled in social media, but he did a quick pivot and decided the irony would be a selling point. A man stopped by our table on his way out.
"Excuse me," he interrupted. "You probably don't remember me."
The reporter shook his head. But it was me the man was addressing.
"We were on a CLE panel a while back, on multi-district litigation, I think."
"Of course." I held out my hand. "It's Don, right? How are you?" He seemed pleased to be recognized.
"I just wanted to say hello and wish you well."
I thanked him warmly.
"Does that happen often?" the reporter asked after the lawyer left.
"At least once a day.
It's amazing, really, how little stigma a murder charge carries. It's because your case is so easy to relate to. Everybody dreads being stuck in an elevator. Then throw in a gun and an unstable passenger. It's their worst nightmare. I finished my spinach and mushroom crepe, promised the reporter my decision soon, and left him with the check. Then it was another limo ride, farther downtown, to the offices of the Harrington firm. Mark had tasked me with finding any evidence that North Star or its attorneys had conducted a reverse auction and reached a secret deal with Ned Bartman. So far, I'd taken the depositions of two of the company's senior executives. Today, I'd scheduled the deposition of its CEO, a man named Nelson Ledbetter. Dick Harrington had sent an underling to the previous depositions, but he was there in person today to defend his client's CEO. Also present was Ned Bartman, Mark's rival for class counsel, along with a young associate from Bartman's office, a nervous-looking boy named Joshua Mattson, who sat at his boss's elbow and took notes. Ledbetter was a Houston transplant, whose elevated status in the company apparently spared him from having to know anything. In his laconic Texas drawl, he denied knowing whether the company's lawyers had conducted a reverse auction among the firms vying to be class counsel. He denied knowing Ned Bartman, or having seen him before today. He denied knowing anyone else in Bartman's firm. He denied knowing whether North Star had entered into any agreement with Bartman to limit the company's monetary exposure. And he even denied knowing what a reverse auction was. The other two North Star executives I'd deposed had been equally unburdened with any knowledge. But that was fine by me. This was a long game I was playing, and I had them on the record now. As all the players packed up their briefcases to go, I handed my card to the court reporter and ordered an overnight transcript. Then I tucked another card into the pants pocket of young Joshua Mattson. On the back, I'd written, "Drinks tonight?" Lunch was next on my schedule, this time at the Four Seasons. Nearly every day since I'd been out of Valhalla, I'd had lunch or drinks with lawyers I used to know or wished to meet. I was renewing old acquaintances and making new ones all over town. Everyone I called was curious enough to say yes to my invitation. And as the word got out, I was soon on the receiving end of those invitations. It was more than curiosity. They were fascinated. How could anyone go through what I had and emerge like this? I had not only survived, I had prevailed. Or so they all predicted. It was just as Mrs. Casco taught me. Wear the face you want the world to see, and that's the way the world will see you. Today's invitation came from Joel Edders, my old supervising partner at Jackson Readers, though he'd moved on since then too. The firm's 2008 layoffs had proved insufficient to right their financial ship, so he'd let himself be poached by another firm in 2009. He ordered a good wine to celebrate. Whether my release from detention or my return to the practice of law wasn't clear. "When this is all over, I hope you'll consider coming to my shop," he said, his glass held high. "It'd be great to work with you again." I smiled. "When this is all over? You make it sound like beating a murder rap is no harder than passing the bar. Equally a snap for you, I bet." We tussled briefly over the check. I wanted to thank him for telling Mark Ivins about me, and he no doubt wanted to make up for how he'd abandoned me 5 years ago. I let him win. Next stop was Dev Kapoor's office in Midtown. It was on the 10th floor, and as we went up the stairs, I could hear Alice breathing hard behind me. She was in good shape for her age, excellent really, but she was growing weary of the climbs, as was I. Dev's office was an unprepossessing space. It had utilitarian furniture and nothing but a potted palm and a few framed prints by way of decoration. Dev obviously felt no need to impress. He was a criminal defense lawyer
and his clients were all preoccupied with the charges hanging over their heads. Any more decor would have been wasted on them. He came out himself to greet me when I arrived in reception. He was as unprepossessing as his office. A small, dark-skinned man, 6 inches shorter than I was in my 4-inch heels. A first-generation American, he had formal manners and a deferential attitude, an unexpected trait in most lawyers, and certainly in one who'd enjoyed such a meteoric rise in the defense bar. He was not yet 40, and already famous from coast to coast. Good news," he said, beaming, as Alice took a seat in the waiting room. He led me down the hall to his conference room. Two other men stood up as I entered. The older one was Paul Scheckler, an academic type in tweed, whom Dev had hired to analyze CDMI's surveillance videos and HR documents. With him was a young techie named John Banoff, who was dressed in the techie uniform of logoed t-shirt and Chuck Taylors. Scheckler would be the witness on the stand, but Banoff was the one who'd done the work, and he did most of the talking in today's meeting. His conclusion? The timestamp had been altered on each of the 3 video clips produced by CDMI, as well as on my so-called termination form. He knew that because of something he called second precision truncation. Before they were tampered with, the timestamps had 100 nanosecond resolution, he explained. But the software used to manipulate them had truncated the time to second precision. He couldn't say when the videos were actually recorded or when the HR form had been completed, but he could say with a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the timestamps had been manipulated. His explanation was lengthy and detailed, and I was bored. I already knew the timestamps were altered and didn't really care how, so long as the testimony would hold up in court. Dev was clearly elated, though, which told me that he hadn't been sure of my innocence before. Not that it mattered. A text hit my phone, and I read it under the table. It was from Ned Bartman's young associate, Joshua Mattson. When and where? Banoff had written a 50-page report supporting his conclusion, and Scheckler had signed it, and for an additional fee was prepared to testify to it. At the end of the meeting, they distributed electronic copies of the report to Dev and me. I immediately forwarded it to Mark Ivins. He'd paid for it, after all. Dev showed the 2 men out and returned to the conference room. He was still beaming. I'll study the report tonight, and if everything looks good, I'll send it to the DA in the morning. I shook my head. Not yet. His smile faltered. Why wait? Once they see this, they'll dismiss the charges. Within the week, I'd wager. Then what? Then? He seemed to be puzzled by my apparent obtuseness. Then it will be over. Except that it won't. I'll still have this hanging over me. People will be whispering about me and speculating about what really happened for the rest of my life. It's not our burden to prove what really happened. It is, though, I said. We have to play the long game, Dev. He deferred to me again, showing only the smallest of frowns as he moved on to the next items on my to-do list. His investigator had traveled to the federal penitentiary in Kansas to interview my half-brother Roger. He said he'd absolutely sign a statement that he never gave or sold you a firearm or even spoke to you in the last 20 years, but only in exchange for $50,000, which of course would render the statement utterly worthless. Good old Roger, I muttered. I wasn't surprised. The good news is he's not cooperating with the DA either. He agreed to give them a statement, saying the opposite, I assume, but only in exchange for a pardon. There's no risk? None, Dev assured me. Even if the DA were willing, the feds would never agree. So the bottom line on the gun is that, yes, your estranged half-brother purchased a dozen DIY kits from the same manufacturer as the elevator gun. Elevator gun was the euphemism Dev employed to avoid saying murder weapon. But thousands of those kits were sold, and there's no way to source the elevator gun to the kits sold to your brother. but also no way to source it to Lucy. Yes, but remember, he checked himself before reminding me yet again about the burden of proof. Final item, he said, pivoting. Your husband. I tensed. You found him? Not quite, but we learned that he was picked up for possession last month. Where? Dev's investigator had been searching for David in all our old haunts in the Bronx. Our apartment building, Cubby's Bar, the bodega on the corner, the plasma donation center. Outside a club in Tribeca, Dev said. He gave his address as the Hyatt House in Chelsea, but he'd already checked out by the time the police followed up. Tribeca and Chelsea. These were his stomping grounds back in our glory days. Sounds like he came into some money, I said. Dev nodded. Alice stood up as I returned to the reception area. She opened the outer door to check the public corridor, and her eyes grew suddenly wide. She stepped aside to let a man come through. He wore sunglasses despite the dim light in the corridor, and he ducked his head as he slipped past us. What? I whispered as Alice hustled me to the stairwell. I wondered if Barrett had put a new tail on me. Didn't you see who that was? Who? That movie star, Luke Rafferty. I laughed. That's why you look so starstruck. She blushed, and I continued to tease her about it all the way to the ground floor. I was just stepping into the revolving doors to the street when I spotted a more familiar figure. Lester was parked down the block, in a blue sedan this time, though that did nothing to disguise him. His head grazed the ceiling where he sat behind the wheel. Alice, I said. I see him. She spoke into her earpiece, and in seconds, Lonnie pulled up and double parked right out front. The rear door sprang open, and Alice steered me in a crouching run into the back seat. She jumped in after me, and Lonnie took off with a squeal of tires. I looked back through the rear window as we passed Lester's car. I nodded at him, and he nodded back. I got a text from Mark as we drove north. He'd read the video expert's report and wanted to celebrate. Great news. Come up for a drink when you get back. It hadn't taken long for me to figure out that he was living full-time in his fifth-floor apartment. I saw him one night padding around barefoot while I worked late in the library. From my basement apartment, I often heard him moving about the building. Late at night, I heard female voices too, coming from the fifth floor. Once, I recognized Phoebe's laugh. The other giggles came in other voices. Just a quick one, I texted back to Mark. I have plans tonight. Okay, see you at 6, he replied. Lonnie pulled up in front of the office, and Alice did a quick swivel scan of the street before she opened the car door for me and escorted me down the stairs to my apartment. She hovered by my side while I swiped my keycard through the lock on the door. I'll be back at 7, she said. I turned to thank her and came to an abrupt stop. Detective Joe Riley was coming out of the office door one flight up. Detective, I called as Alice darted in front of me. I leaned around her. Did you wish to see me? He looked as startled as I felt. He came slowly down the stairs to street level. I was hoping to grab a minute with your boss. He was wearing the same sad sack suit he'd worn during my long day in Interview A, and I could only imagine how out of place he must have looked in the grand reception room of Mark Ivins and Associates. But it seems he is not available. Perhaps I could help, I said. As I came halfway up my own flight of stairs, Alice positioned herself between me and the street. She was on high alert, scanning the parked cars at the curb, scanning the surrounding rooftops. I shouldn't really talk to you, Riley said, seeing as you're represented by counsel. I smiled. That's a rule designed to protect the unwitting. I don't think I'm in any danger. He hesitated. Still and all. Could you take this inside? Alice said in a low voice. That seemed to decide him. He followed me as I turned down the stairs toward my apartment. Alice usually left me at the threshold, but this time she came in and pressed the door shut with her back. She stood sentry there as I led Riley inside.
"Nice digs,"
he said, his head swiveling to take it in. In a lower voice, he said,
"What's with the bodyguard?"
I put my briefcase on the kitchen counter. It seems I'm being followed. His caterpillar eyebrows crawled upward.
"Barrett?"
When I didn't answer, he said,
"You should have called the police."
Oh, right, because my last encounter went so well. To his credit, he looked away. I watched him amble a few steps deeper into the apartment before I asked, "Is this the part where you guys ask for a drink of water or to use the bathroom?"
"Hey."
He looked back at me, umbrage taken.
"You invited me in."
"I was joking, detective." Nonetheless, I took out a glass and filled it at the sink and placed it between us on the counter. "Have some water anyway." He cracked a smile and took the glass. "What did you want to see Mr. Ivins about?"
"I thought we might compare notes. I assume he's been gathering evidence in his lawsuit against your old company."
"And you want to compare his evidence with, what, your evidence against me?" I let out a little laugh. "Why, detective, are you taking another look at your own case?" He shrugged.
"Just, you know, dotting all the I's."
"Without Detective Cruz?"
"He's busy on an active case."
"And you're not?" He didn't answer. He lifted his glass and studied me over the rim as he took a slow swallow.
"I wanted to ask Ivins if he ever came across anything about some charter flights out of Myanmar."
Relief flowed through me like a warm stream. At last, he'd finally looked at the documents in my briefcase. "Those documents are confidential," I said.
"And confusing,"
he said.
"I can't make heads or tails out of them."
My relief faded.
"Well, best be going."
He drained the glass and placed it on the counter. "Bathroom's free," I pointed. He huffed a laugh and brushed past Alice, who still stood, stone-faced, at the door. I changed out of my suit into a casual summer dress, and at 6, I climbed the stairs to Mark's apartment. He hollered for me to come in when I knocked, and I opened the door to the aroma of sizzling beef. Mark had a personal chef named Kevin Ho, who was more or less on retainer, and he was in the kitchen tonight, slicing and dicing vegetables on the counter. Mark was nowhere in sight. I wandered into the living room. The apartment was decorated in the same clean lines and cool grays and blues as my apartment in the basement. It was in stark contrast to the opulent reds and golds and ornate trimmings of his public space. Those rooms were like the mane of a lion or the tail of a peacock, a display to impress, or really to intimidate his visitors. But he didn't need to intimidate anyone in his private space. The people he invited here already knew how formidable he was.
"Be right out," he called from another room. "Fix yourself a drink."
He'd been working. His laptop was open on the coffee table, and a document lay beside it. I skipped the bar and did a quick, stealthy skim of the document. It was a draft settlement agreement in the Genco case. One section gave the shareholders he represented the right to appoint 5 new board members. I flipped a few more pages and confirmed that it was a 9-member board. So Mark would indeed have control of the company. He came out as I was admiring a small stainless steel nude on a bookshelf. He was dressed as casually as I was, more so since he was barefoot.
"You're right," he said, taking in my empty hands. "We shouldn't have drinks. This calls for champagne."
He gathered up his papers and conferred briefly with Kevin in the kitchen. I heard the pop of the cork, and Mark returned bearing 2 flutes.
"Here's to exoneration,"
he said, handing me a glass.
He was still smiling as he uttered his next words. Those filthy sons of bitches. Mmm. I took a swallow. The champagne danced on my tongue and brought a swoosh of memories. David in a VIP room at a dance club. David toasting me at our wedding reception. David shaking a bottle before he popped the cork and let a geyser of champagne spray over his head. That was the night he got his bonus check, the one that proved to be the last. And there was one final memory. While packing up to steal out of our apartment in the dead of the night, David had found the forgotten Magnum at the back of the fridge, left over from the day of my layoff, and chugged it straight from the bottle. I thought of him now, clubbing in Tribeca, staying in our old neighborhood, pretending he could ever get that life back.
After what they tried to do to you, Shay, Mark was saying. Well, what am I saying? What they actually did. You spent 2 months in jail, after all. Your civil suit against that company is going to be epic.
Yes, I've been thinking about that.
I'd be happy to represent you, believe me.
I gave him a look. But of course, you couldn't.
Why not?
He spread his arms wide and boastful.
I can handle more than shareholder litigation, you know.
But you represent the shareholders of CDMI, whose stock value would take a serious dive if I got a big damages award against the company. After a beat of silence, he shrugged.
Right.
It must be hard to remember who your clients are, I said, when they're only names on a roster. He bristled a bit at the dig.
That's not true. I'm always acting in their best interests. That's why I filed the Palmer suit. Management's been feeding at the shareholders' trough for too many years. I want to bring them down, Shay. I want to destroy every last motherfucking one of them.
You're not supposed to discuss that with me, I reminded him. Something was hissing in the kitchen, and another aroma wafted out, the sweet, pungent smell of garlic.
We could do it, you and me together.
I didn't answer that time. He pulled a sad mouth to show he understood, then changed the subject.
How are you coming on North Star?
I deposed Nelson Ledbetter today. He cocked his head.
Remind me?
CEO.
Oh, right. Get anything out of him?
I shook my head. It was the same as all the other North Star executives. He never discussed Bartman with anyone at Harrington or anyone inside North Star. He never met anyone at Bartman's firm. He never discussed with anyone the idea of shopping among potential class counsel for the cheapest settlement. He was appalled at the very notion.
Mark shrugged. Well, who knows? Maybe it never happened.
He grinned.
I might have to win class counsel purely on my merits.
Let's not give in yet, I laughed. I still have some ideas percolating.
I knew you would. Hey, how about we take this upstairs?
I hadn't dressed for the outdoors, but he tossed me a suede bomber jacket to put on. He stayed as he was, down to the bare feet.
Kevin, we'll be upstairs, he shouted on our way out.
You're entertaining tonight? I asked as we climbed the narrow stairs to the rooftop garden.
Well, you told me you'd be out.
He pretended to be sorrowful.
So I had to find somebody else to fill my lonely night.
Up on the roof, the lights of the city glowed around us like a forest of fireflies. Mark pushed a button on the gas fireplace beside the dining table, and the flames flickered on. I took the chair nearest to the fire, and Mark pulled his in close beside mine. Close enough that I could feel his arm press against mine through the suede sleeve of his jacket. I didn't pull away. I wasn't worried about his intentions. I knew exactly what his intentions were. He intended to sit back and wait for me to make the first move. That was his established MO. It had become obvious to me in the last 3 weeks, not only in how he behaved toward me, but in how he behaved toward all the other women in the office. He believed himself to be so desirable to women that he never had the burden of initiating the seduction. He could rely on his conquests wanting to conquer him. This was what he considered his greatest strength, his sexual magnetism, his utter irresistibility. I'd thought about it a good deal, especially when I thought about jujitsu, how to use his greatest strength against him. Ideas were percolating. He refilled my glass as Kevin trotted up the stairs. "Thought you might like some go-withs," Kevin said, flourishing a plate of tiny savory tarts.
"Ah, this is a favorite of mine," Mark said. "Thanks, Kevin."
He picked one up as the chef galloped back downstairs.
"Try it," he said,
and finger-fed it to me.
"Good, right?"
Mmm. It was filled with goat cheese and fennel and melted into a buttery glow on my tongue.
"God,"
he burst out unexpectedly.
"It kills me to think of what they did to you, and why. That's what's driving me crazy."
I swallowed. "I wish I could tell you." He popped a tart into his own mouth and looked thoughtful while he chewed.
"Interesting phrasing you used there," he said finally. "Like it could be either I wish I knew, or I wish I weren't subject to a gag order. I don't suppose you could tell me which."
I regarded him for a moment, as if deliberating. "The latter."
"I knew it. God damn it. They're covering up something so heinous that it made that woman kill herself. They couldn't risk anyone finding out what, so they made it look like you killed her."
"Sounds pretty fantastical when you say it."
"But you lived it. They did it to you, Shay. The old men who wrote the rules of attorney-client confidentiality, they never imagined a situation like this one."
I looked away. "I'm sorry, Mark, I can't discuss it." He was silent for a time before he gave up and changed the subject. He wanted to know about the reporters vying for my story and which way I was leaning.
"You know," he mused after I gave him the rundown, "why give the story to any of them? No one could tell it better than you could yourself. You should do a book. I know a few publishers. Work up a pitch, then sit back and wait for the bidding war."
"Only if I'm acquitted."
"You will be. Of course you will. You know,"
he was thinking again,
"we could collaborate on a book." "Yeah."
He sat up excitedly.
"How you were framed, and how the two of us exposed it and toppled the evil scum who did it to you. What do you say?"
"It's too soon to say anything." He leaned back with a shrug, conceding the point for the moment.
"Well, it's also too soon to give an exclusive to anyone else. Whatever you do, make sure you reserve the right to publish your own story."
"That's good advice. Thank you, Mark." I got to my feet. "I'd better head down now." He looked at his watch and nodded, and he got up and followed me down the stairs. At the fifth floor landing, he pushed the call button for the elevator. "No, I'll walk," I said. I handed him his jacket and started for the next flight of stairs. He stopped me with a hand on my arm and a look of genuine concern on his face.
"I don't get it, Shay. How can you be so fearless about everything else? The whole fucking state of New York is after you, and you're undaunted. But you can't step inside an elevator."
I took a shaky breath. "I just need a little more time."
"You have to get back on that horse, Shay."
"Soon, Mark," I said, as I pulled free and started down the stairs. "I promise." At the second floor landing, I heard a buzz of voices coming from the main conference room. I crossed the hall and poked my head in. A half dozen young men and women were going through stacks of documents spread out over the table. "Sorry," I said when they looked up. "Didn't mean to interrupt." A skinny boy in a skinny tie shot to his feet.
"Hey, you're her, aren't you? Shay Lambert."
I nodded as the others murmured around the table. "We're working on your document production," another one said.
"Mine?
CDMIs." "Oh." I scanned the piles of paper. These had to be the documents I'd worked on in the lab. "I'm afraid I'm not allowed to talk to you. Chinese wall, please excuse me." I headed down another flight to the main floor. Phoebe was chatting with Louisa at the reception desk,
and she gave me a bright smile. I see we have some new hires, I said. She looked blank. In the library? Reviewing documents? Oh, right. No, they're not new hires. They're law students doing an internship. Paid? Well, no. She pursed her lips. But really, it's an honor for them just to be allowed to work here. Joshua Mattson was already there when I arrived at the Midtown Wine Bar. He was waiting at a little round table in the corner. When I came through the door, he rose awkwardly, knocked his glass with his elbow, and dove to right it before it toppled over. He recovered, barely, and held out his hand as I threaded my way toward him. I ignored it and went in for the European kiss on each cheek. When I pulled back, his face was flushed red. With a shy smile, he pulled out a chair for me. I scooted closer as Alice situated herself in an inconspicuous spot by the door. Thanks so much for meeting me, Joshua. Call me Josh? Josh, I said with a smile. I realize this is a little irregular, what with our firms competing for class counsel, but I wanted to get to know you better. His eyes shone behind his glasses. Really? Not really. I already knew what I needed to know about him. I'd profiled him online. He'd majored in humanities at Oberlin and graduated from Berkeley Law with dreams of practicing good law. A lot of law students started out that way. They thought they'd do civil rights or environmental law or death penalty cases. 5 years later, they were doing tax law and defending polluters. But Josh stuck to his guns and went to work for Ned Bartman, who, like Mark, touted himself as a crusader against corporate malfeasance. The other things I'd learned about Josh? He was 26 and had an out-of-shape body, an unfortunate nose, and no social media indication of any woman in his life. I read your law review article, I told him, on whistleblower protections. I was so impressed. Oh. He seemed embarrassed by his obvious pleasure and took a quick gulp of his drink to conceal it. He became even more embarrassed when he realized I didn't yet have a drink. Oh, he said again. What can I get you? I asked for a white wine spritzer, and while he went to the bar, I tucked my chair in closer to his. He returned with a glass for me, and I tapped it briefly against his. Your article, it shows such incredible scholarship, I said. I know Mark would love to have that kind of intellect on our team. Wow, thanks, he said. I was wondering, in the course of your thinking on these issues, did you consider the quandary faced by a potential whistleblower who's a lawyer? How do you mean? The lawyer has an express duty of loyalty to his client, but what if the client's done something that the lawyer feels a moral obligation to report? How do you reconcile those conflicts? Well, the rules are pretty clear, he said. If the client's about to do something illegal, the lawyer can reveal it, but not if it's already been done. What if the bad act's already been done, but the client continues to profit from it? I'm struggling with that. He blinked a few times behind his smudged lenses. Well, let's say a lawyer in a law firm, or a corporate law department, discovers something nefarious, some wrongdoing that really ought to be exposed, but he'd have to breach confidentiality and loyalty to do it. How do you reconcile your duty to do good with your duties as a lawyer? His mouth was hanging open. He snapped it shut. I knew it. You found out something at CDMI. It's why they framed you, to discredit you if you go public. I sighed and looked away long enough for him to feel certain he'd guessed correctly. I wonder if you'd be willing to give that question some thought, I said finally. And if you come up with anything, anything at all, let me know. I don't expect you to go on the record. Any advice you're willing to give me, I'll absolutely keep to myself. I laid my hand on his knee and felt a muscle jump against my palm. I wish we had someone like you at Mark Ivins and Associates. I put a wistful tone in my voice. If you ever want to make a move, Josh, I know Mark would be thrilled.
Oh.
He cleared his throat. Wow. I'm sorry I can't linger. I scooted back my chair. But could we do this again? Sometime soon?
Yes, anytime.
He lurched to his feet, and I stood and kissed him again on both cheeks. Good night, I said. Be good. It was only 8, but I told Alice I'd be in for the rest of the night, and she took me home and tucked me in. As soon as she was gone, I slipped out through the French doors to the rear garden and scanned the back of the building. The after-hours security lights gave a dim glow to every floor of the townhouse, except the 5th. The lights were ablaze up there, and I could make out Mark's silhouette at his living room window. He was speaking to someone out of sight. I took the outdoor stairs up to the terrace and slipped my keycard through the lock on the back door. Inside, I stopped and listened. And when I heard no one, I stole up the grand staircase to the 2nd-floor conference room. I shone my cell phone flashlight over the conference table. I suspected that our unpaid interns hadn't been apprised of the terms of the Chinese wall. And I was right. The CDMI files were supposed to be locked up and password protected, but here they all were, free for the perusing. I hurried from stack to stack until I located the files on the Paradis sur Terre asset sales. Then I did a quick skim, just long enough to confirm that the sales figures were still artificially inflated. Barrett hadn't backed off from his scheme. He'd already done his worst, and he was seeing it through to the end. That was all I needed to know. I turned off the light, and as I crept out into the corridor, Mark's voice drifted down the stairs from the 5th-floor landing. I couldn't make out his words, but I knew that tone. He was laughing with the little edge of naughtiness that he seemed to delight in. I wondered what young woman he was entertaining tonight. I wondered if Phoebe minded when it wasn't her. Then the second voice sounded, and it wasn't a woman at all. It was a man, speaking in a deep, laconic drawl. And I knew that voice instantly. I knew because I'd listened to it for 2 hours straight that very morning. It was Nelson Ledbetter, CEO of North Star, the man who knew nothing. I smiled as I crept my way back downstairs. If my long game was on a chessboard, I'd just seen, or rather heard, my path to checkmate. So, 3 weeks in, this was my new life. I had a prestigious position, a luxurious apartment, a fabulous wardrobe, and $50,000 in GoFundMe cash. What a contrast from my life in Valhalla. In hindsight, my time there felt like only a lull in the action, the interval in a 2-act play. Now, Act 2 was underway, and it was time to pick up the pace. I felt like a circus performer who'd hoisted a dozen plates into the air, and they were all spinning on their poles in gyroscopic swirls. I lay awake in bed that night, my mind churning with how to bring each one down and set it carefully into place on my imaginary table. I was still awake when I heard the low whine of the elevator. My eyes opened, and I counted off the floors as it descended. 4. Then 3, then 2, then the main floor, where it should have stopped. But it didn't. It continued down to the basement. I slipped out of bed and went into the hall. The elevator opened 2 ways on this level, so Mark could have been headed for a late-night workout. But it was the doorknob on my side that moved. It turned slowly until it met the lock and stopped. I felt certain that Mark's keycard opened every lock in the building, but I wasn't worried that he'd use it. I knew he was only checking to see if I'd left the door unlocked, if this might be the night I'd finally give in to my desire. Soon, Mark, I promise, I thought, as the elevator whined its way back up to the top.